And now, The Federal Drive with Tom Temin, sponsored by GEHA.
Hello, and thanks for joining us on this Wednesday, April 17th, 2024, 7 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Temin. Our producers are Eric White and Peter Masurlian, our digital editors, Daisy Thornton, Michelle Sandiford, and Darris Lauderdale. Coming up in this hour of The Federal Drive, Veterans Affairs IG has some advice for that troubled new electronic health record. Plus, the rollout of a new financial system at the National Weather Service has been less predictable than the weather itself. Those stories and much more ahead during this hour of The Federal Drive. But first, new data from the Government Accountability Office estimates agencies lost as much as $521 billion in programmatic fraud between 2018 and 2022. The Office of Management and Budget strongly disagrees with that estimate. It questions the plausibility of GAO's assessment. No matter what the real amount of fraud is across the government, and agencies may never know for sure, the Treasury Department is giving agencies some tools to stop fraud before it starts. For more about how the agencies can use these tools, Federal News Network's Jason Miller spoke with the Fiscal Assistant Secretary at the Treasury Department, David Liebrich.
Oftentimes, it was very difficult to raise our hand in real time and say, we can get money out the door and prevent fraud at the same time. We have something called the Center of Payment Integrity, in which we have a number of databases that we allow agencies to match against. And that includes looking at things like eligibility verification, making sure we're not paying dead people, for example, understanding whether the vendor has problems and we shouldn't be doing business with the vendor, whether there's been someone incarcerated, and other kind of eligibility criteria, the data that we can provide. In addition, we're also offering a service called account verification services, in which we can make sure that when a payment goes to a bank account, it is in fact going to a real bank account holder. And so we can do that in real time. And third, we've had some success with really looking at check fraud and how we can minimize check fraud, which is a problem that's it's impacting, you know, in the private sector and in the banking world is a really big problem. And the government, while we have done a lot to try to make sure that most of our payments, in fact, close to 98% of our payments are electronic, that last 2% that are checks, we want to make sure that we have a lot of protection and prevention around those checks. So we've recently implemented a tool which uses machine learning to actually look for anomalies on those 40 million checks that we issue. And if we see an anomaly, that we actually flag that check and let the financial institution know that there's a potential problem with it. And to date, that tool has stopped over $500 million of fraudulent payments that have gone out, that would have gone out otherwise. Very good collaboration with the IG community with that tool and allowing us to then use it to actually bring more cases against fraudsters. But we have a lot more opportunity to do even more of that kind of thing.
That's a great news story, David, that I think sometimes doesn't get told enough. And you and I have talked about this over the years, that there's always a lot of really interesting and important efforts going on that maybe don't get enough sunlight. So I appreciate you bringing the sunlight. Maybe talk a little bit more about that tool without getting into the deep dive of the technology. You mentioned machine learning, looking for anomalies. And I know there may be some sensitivities built in, but generally, how does it work? Does it check against what or give me a sense of the how?
So like in the case of much of machine learning, when you're looking at large data sets, what it allows you to do is to, with great deal of speed, to look at where there are anomalies. And so as those checks are going through and they're scanning the checks, they're seeing if something looks unusual. Those models get refined as time goes on to say the false positive gets removed. And so that you have more and more confidence that when you actually identify a problem with that check, that you have confidence that it really has a problem with it. And so this is another case which I would say is that we, the government, have limited capability to design quickly new technology and skills that the private sector is actually investing a lot of money in. And so this is another example where we have leveraged the private sector, and we will continue to level the private sector in terms of looking at really their tools, the tools that are being used that we might be able to take advantage of.
Now, was this started as a pilot and you're expanding it? Where are you at with this? Because you mentioned you recently implemented the tool. Is it being used on a limited number of accounts, meaning the payments that are going out? You mentioned about 40 million in checks, or is it going across all checks that are going out across all parts of the government? Give me a little more details.
Yeah. So you always start when you introduce new technology into environment, you do want to test to make sure it's right. And as I mentioned to you before, you test with, especially with things like machine learning, is you have to bring a lot of data in, and you want to make sure that you're running a lot of data through to make sure that you eliminate the false positives, and you fine tune the tool. We are now using it full out on all of the on all checks that are being presented to the through the Federal Reserve to the Treasury, and that information that is going back to financial institutions in really near real time, so that the financial institution can take quick action. We are also going to be holding an industry day shortly. You mentioned, what other opportunities there are, in which we have asked the private sector to come in and tell us what kinds of tools they're using, to explore with them about which of those tools may be appealing to us or have potential applicability in our environment.
And this industry day is more than just checks, because as you said, about 98% of all money going out the door is electronic. So it's a problem, but not the biggest problem. This is really looking at data and tools to stop fraud, to reduce improper payments, I would imagine.
Exactly. And I would also put it in the same category, while it's not artificial intelligence or machine learning, I mentioned the account verification system, in which we're actually, when we issue a check, we're bouncing it to make sure that the account is legitimate and that the payment should go there. And as a result, when we did the economic impact payments, child tax credit payments, we were able to virtually eliminate fraud in the electronic payment realm because we were actually making sure it was a legitimate account. And we did two things with economic impact payments, which I think is very important. We started using the account verification tool, as well as started to say, if we were going to make an economic impact payment to an individual who already was receiving a government payment, and we were comfortable that that was a legitimate account, we flipped some of those payments to go directly to those accounts. And so that ability to do that significantly reduced fraud, but also importantly, it made for a much better end user experience. You know, it was safer, faster, and more secure actually to have that payment go electronically than it would have been to send a check, in which you may have had a problem of someone either intercepting a check or alternatively altering the check and creating a bigger problem.
The other thing I want to just go back to real quick is the account verification piece. Now, are these tools like account verification, like some of the do not pay lists, some of the other things, is that open for anybody to use? Meaning, is it a fee for service, or if it is, it's something that most agencies can pay for? Give me a sense of who can use the tools and how do they get to that point?
Treasury in many ways plays a central role in many things like issuance of payments and collecting of money and financing the government. And so these are services that are free to agencies, and we want to encourage agencies to actually use these databases and to run their payments against those databases. Now, in the end, the agency has to make a determination about whether they want that payment to go through or not. With so many payments that we issue, we don't have the ability to make judgments ourselves at Treasury. Only the agency can make a judgment about whether it's a payment that they'd like to make or not make, because they're the ones who provide us the amount and the person who's actually going to receive the payment. And so one of the challenges I think that we face is, how do we make sure that agencies have the capability to use our services? And then once they get the information back from us, what do they do with that information? And in some cases, you know, there are situations where a hit will occur, and in fact, it should be a payment. It's legitimate. And there are other cases where it really should be a flag. And I think as we look into the future and trying to really develop these capabilities, we should be scoring every payment that the government makes. So we should be putting some sort of confidence level around that payment. And I think in the future, with some of the tools that are out there, we should be able to do that. And you then can refine those that scoring as you go along. You get more confidence. And so really, in many cases, like, for example, in a natural disaster, when you make a payment, that's a moment where there's a high potential for fraud. And so in that particular case, if you're sending a payment to a new bank account, you might have more of a concern about whether that is, in fact, a appropriate payment. If, on the other hand, during a natural disaster, you're sending that payment to someone who's been receiving Social Security for the last 10 years, you have a high confidence that that payment is probably going to the right person, that there's not fraud attached. And so I think as we get more sophisticated and our tools grow, we should be able to give agencies a better sense of exactly, you know, where does that payment fall in that spectrum. And I would also mention one other thing along these lines. What we've seen in the private sector as we've gone out and spoken is, you get more confidence around these scores, the better you are at aggregating different data sources. And so things like, is it a new bank account? Is it a foreign address, an international address? You know, there's kinds of things where you're trying to pull information that sort of gives you a better confidence about the integrity of that payment.
Dave LaBrick, the Fiscal Assistant Secretary at the Treasury Department, speaking with Federal News Network's Jason Miller. Check out Jason's story at federalnewsnetwork.com. Still to come, the rollout of a new financial system at the National Weather Service has been less predictable than the weather. This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. Welcome back to the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Network. Last year, the Commerce Department rolled out a new financial management system meant to improve the department's financial management. However, things have not quite gone as planned. Implementation issues have resulted in National Weather Service employees not getting reimbursed and electric companies shutting off power to equipment used by NOAA. Bloomberg government reporter Jack Fitzpatrick broke the story late last week and spoke further with Federal News Network's Eric White.
The Department of Commerce was instituting and still is in the process of instituting a new financial system that their payments go through. They started at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which includes the National Weather Service, which a lot of people are familiar with. And they put it in place last October. We still don't know the full extent of how bad this was, but long story short, it did not let payments go through. It didn't actually let the money go out of the system for invoices or travel reimbursements to their own employees in thousands of cases, totaling at least tens of millions of dollars, according to an inspector general report. And that caused some significant issues. They weren't paying their electric bills in some places. I spoke to the manager of an airport in Georgia who unexpectedly lost access to a NOAA system that provides weather information to pilots. It was fortunate that weather wasn't very bad that day. Otherwise, flights might have been redirected. There's an instance where NOAA weather radio went down in Alabama because they lost power to their radio transmitter in Cullman, Alabama. There was a meteorologist who travels to the site of natural disasters who for more than 5 months could not have traveled because he had maxed out his government travel card and wasn't getting the money to actually pay that off. So some significant issues essentially based on NOAA not being able to pay its bills for a number of months.
Does the agency know, you know, what the root cause is, or was it just simple, you know, growing pains of bringing in a new system?
If they know for sure, they have not said publicly. The Inspector General report on this said that on the invoice side, there was a data mismatch between this new system at NOAA and the system that the Treasury Department uses. I have followed up with the Inspector General's office to say, hey, can you explain what exactly the data mismatch was? They have directed me to the Department of Commerce. NOAA has not explained, and the employees affected have not gotten an explanation. So when you talk to a meteorologist or a local emergency management person who's affected by the issue, they still have not been told, hey, here's how this got messed up, and here's what we're doing to fix it.
Yeah, and I'm sure that those employees' union reps were frothing at the mouth as soon as they heard that employees were not being reimbursed for business expenses.
Yes, there actually was a grievance filed by the union that represents National Weather Service employees that mentioned 25 employees of the National Weather Service who were waiting for months for travel reimbursements, in many cases totaling thousands of dollars. The person I talked to was owed $5,400 for more than 5 months. And according to the union, it affected 25 people. And that's aside from issues with paying contractors, paying the electric bill, that kind of thing.
We're speaking with Jack Fitzpatrick from Bloomberg Government. And so I imagine with employees being directly affected by this problem, this wasn't a whistleblower case, so to speak, just because it would be so out in the open and so many people were affected. But it has kind of been kept under wraps. I mean, how did you yourself come across this story?
The first way I came across it was because of the National Weather Service Employees Union. There have been for years some issues with the National Weather Service being understaffed in areas. Congress has discussed that. I wanted to learn more about a variety of those issues. I coincidentally called the new president of the Employees Union for the National Weather Service not long after they filed the grievance. She mentioned that to me. And it was clear that this was a broader issue. It's the travel reimbursements not going out to employees, but also it blocked a lot of payments. So between that and then reaching out to a lot of local people who were affected because, you know, the NOAA weather radio went down in Alabama for a little while, that kind of thing, I have pieced together this story. But I do think there is probably a greater extent and a greater breadth than I have even learned. So I'm still working on learning exactly where and how these problems have happened, because it does seem to be quite widespread.
I know that you said the agency hasn't outlined exactly what went wrong, but let's go back to implementing this new system overall. Was there a need to shore up? I imagine that purchasing can always get more efficient, especially when you're talking about big agencies. Is that what the case was? It was meant to streamline things and, you know, obviously make things easier, and it just hasn't gone to plan?
Yeah, it was meant to streamline things. This is replacing a system that had been in place at Commerce for a number of years, I think more than 20 years. And employees have said, look, there should be advantages, and it's likely that there still will be. But the issue was they didn't understand how difficult it would be. Evidently, there was a data mismatch that caused more problems than expected. And there were cases where the communication wasn't where it needed to be. I spoke to the chief meteorologist at the Huntsville, Alabama National Weather Service office, who, after their problems getting the money out the door, despite his efforts to pay the electric bill, said the lesson learned from his end is you have to communicate to vendors, to contractors, to everybody. We're going to have to work through some issues. Let's communicate ahead of time. And that is one of the shortcomings here, was that a lot of people were left in the dark, and then power was cut off in some cases without a heads up.
Yeah, when you're talking about major pieces of infrastructure and safety going down like that, I'm going to guess that members of Congress were probably piling on about the agency's problems as well.
It did get to Congress. I know that in one instance in Alabama, the radio transmitter that went down is right where Robert Adderholt is based. He's from the Cullman, Alabama area. Adderholt is a senior appropriator, a pretty influential member of the House. I heard from the locals there that they struggled to get traction until they reached out to Congressman Adderholt. And when he followed up, the bill was paid pretty quickly. There hasn't been a lot of finger pointing at Commerce. There haven't been a lot of demands for public answers about this, but at least in that case, I know that it got to a very senior member of the Appropriations Committee who followed up, and that's how that instance was taken care of.
Finally, you know, has the agency given any sort of timeline or any sort of expectation for when these employees will finally be reimbursed for traveling to these disaster zones?
Well, some have been. In fact, the meteorologist who's based in LA, who I talked to, Rich Thompson, first talked to me about his issues, and then shortly before we published the story, he got paid. So we were at least able to confirm that after a little more than 5 months, he did eventually get that $5,400. The agency, though, has not answered questions publicly on where exactly they are in the process of working through that backlog. It does seem that they're paying bills now. It's not that they're building up a greater backlog, but it's a messy experience trying to make those payments. And they have not said how much money they owe at this point, where they are in the process of how many bills still need to be paid. I haven't gotten answers on that, but they seem to still be working on it.
Jack Fitzpatrick, reporter for Bloomberg Government, speaking with Federal News Network's Eric White. We'll post this interview along with a link to Jack's story at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts. Still to come, federal agency performance depends on individual accountability. But first, the Veterans Affairs IG has some advice for that troubled new electronic health record. This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. Welcome back to the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Network. Last month, the Department of Veterans Affairs and the Defense Department launched a new interoperable electronic health record at the Captain James A. Lovell Federal Health Center in North Chicago. It's the first big VA facility to use the EHR. And during that deployment, the agency's inspector general noticed a few challenges presented by the EHR scheduling system. For details, Federal News Network's Eric White spoke with VA's Deputy Assistant IG, Lee Ann Seawright.
As you know, the EHR rollout took a pause in 2022 and then continued through 2023, but DoD was continuing with their implementation. And so because Lovell is a joint facility, VA and DoD wanted to implement the EHR at Lovell. And so we thought it was important to really look back at the prior implementations and look at the issues encountered and then consider that for Lovell, being that it is a more complex facility and the risks of that implementation at that facility.
Gotcha. So you're almost trying to get ahead of the game and work yourself out of a job if a problem does arise later on.
I don't know if we'll ever get there.
All right. So the issue was pertaining to problems with the scheduling system that you saw at smaller facilities that rolled out the EHR. What in particular about this? First off, yeah, if you could just lay out, you know, what is the scheduling system for the new electronic health record? Is it a unique scheduling system or what is it?
No, it's part of the Cerner Oracle package, but scheduling is a critical element of gaining access to any facility, right, or any appointment that you have. And so as focused as VA is on expanding access to facilities, scheduling has a whole level of complexity to it for VA because the VA does so much more for its veterans as it coordinates and, you know, scheduling of appointments. You know, us on the outside maybe don't get that coverage that they do, that veterans get within the VA facilities. That coordination and collaboration between the schedulers and the clinics and the providers, there's a lot of back and forth and a lot of nuance to those processes. And so that's why there is complexity in the scheduling and why we wanted to focus on that.
Yeah, especially, you know, with the backdrop of scheduling has been an issue for the agency famously, you know, in the past couple decades. And, you know, probably one of the main complaints that you hear from people who are under the Veterans Affairs care. Does that stack up as, you know, we really got to get the scheduling part of this right?
Correct. You know, what we found in our previous reviews on scheduling and on other reviews in the EHRM space is that there are some nuances to these scheduling packages. For example, we identified issues with the displaced queue. So when a MSA works a schedule, like for a provider, you know, if that provider needs to take leave or if the provider leaves the organization, you know, that creates a lot of complexity in moving all those existing appointments that need to be rescheduled, canceling them, and then rescheduling them. Under the old system, there were ways that they handled that. Under the new system, they had the ability to block out those schedules and then move them into what they called this displaced queue. So it was an efficiency, but what we found is that appointments seemed to fall off of that queue, and nobody had that visibility to know that those appointments were lost. So maybe a veteran wasn't aware that that appointment was scheduled or rescheduled and shows up to the facility and there's actually no appointment for them, or they fall through the cracks completely and they don't get rescheduled. And so it didn't happen every time the displaced queue was used. And so there's, you know, fixes that need to occur, but those fixes weren't happening fast enough. And so these five facilities that had already fielded EHRM started to work, do their own workarounds, and everybody had a different workaround, and that's not efficient either.
Yeah, I can't imagine, you know, a workaround at a smaller facility is easier to discover than at a large facility where, you know, you find the workaround and that's going to mess up four or five other appointment blocks, I imagine.
Correct.
We're speaking with Lee Ann Seawright from the Office of Inspector General for the Department of Veterans Affairs. And as always, when we're talking about Veterans Affairs, staffing comes into play. You mentioned that that is part of your concerns as well, that the level of staffing and overtime is not quite there yet to meet the pre or regular deployment of the amount of appointment levels that are going to come from the implementation of the new EHR. What did you all have to find on that front?
So when we looked back at the five facilities that have already implemented EHRM, we found that they had beefed up their staffing quite a bit, or if they didn't hire additional, they used an excessive amount of overtime to supplement that. And this was a somewhat cursory review, so we weren't able to get into the depth of like why the scheduling takes that much more. We think there's some complexities to the process. And like we spoke previously, we think facilities create all these workarounds because the rollout of EHRM and the challenges that they haven't done, EHRM IO hasn't done a good job of standardizing some of these issues so that facilities are doing it the same. And so in creating your own workarounds, you're creating other processes. In addition, we found that some of the lack of standardization or decision on making changes to VA's processes, you know, created additional work for VA as well for the schedulers. For example, facilities generally send out a mailing to every veteran for every appointment. You get a letter reminding you that you have an appointment so that, you know, that helps manage our cancellation and no-show rates within the VA. But the new scheduling package doesn't do that. And so facilities were taking it upon themselves to come up with the solution, whether they created the letters themselves, whether they contracted that out. And so those issues, you know, result in more time and more effort. And so as not only learning a new system, but then having to do all these workarounds and deal with these challenges, we think are one of the contributing factors of why they need to hire so many more for these rollouts.
And let's talk about the actual information within the electronic health record. We're still having a persistent problem with inaccurate patient information. Is that coming just from the conversion from one system to this Cerner system, or is something else at play there?
With the rollout of EHRM with the Cerner solution, you know, it is a DOD and a VA. Each has their own systems, but the intent is for that interoperability. And so the federated system that feeds into this system is called DEERS, the Defense and Eligibility and Enrollment System. And so this system, you know, is where when you enter into DOD and you work through DOD, you have all your vital information, right? Your address, all of that. So they're using that as the source of information for veterans. But a lot of these veterans separated from the military many years ago and maybe don't access DEERS any longer. And so that information was out of date. And so VA and DOD have worked to clean up that information, but there's still some misinformation between and misunderstanding and really a lack of awareness at the scheduler level that some of those issues have been fixed. So schedulers are still doing some of those workarounds that might or might not be necessary still because of that communication issue.
And updated data entry means, hey, we need more people to do that too, right?
Correct.
So, you know, you offered no recommendations on this one. Like I said, it was a little bit different from what we usually, you know, see from the IG. Was this more of just, hey, we want to make sure that VHA is aware of these issues as, you know, with, let's take it a little bit slowly this time and know what's going to be coming down the pipeline? Was that the intent here?
Right. So what we issued was a management advisory memo. And so you're right, we did not make any recommendations. That's per that management advisory memo template. So really what we wanted to do is just summarize issues that we had already highlighted. We wrote a report in 2021 on the scheduling issue. We still have recommendations open from that. And we wanted to really summarize all the issues that we've seen and bring that to light. And so that VA had that information at their hand as they went to the level fielding.
Yeah. And, you know, it's called a management alert, but something that kind of, as you mentioned, summarizes everything. It, you know, this could be something that a manager could pass down to those below him or her and say, you know, hey, these are the things to watch out for. Would that be a good use of this document as well?
Absolutely. I mean, as VA continues to make decisions on the implementation of EHRM and improvements on the scheduling package, I think it's a tool that they can refer back to. And for those facilities that have already implemented EHRM, the Cerner solution, I believe that, you know, they could use this to inform their workforce of the changes that have or have not occurred to be aware of that.
Leanne Seawright is Deputy Assistant Inspector General at Veterans Affairs, speaking with Federal News Network's Eric White. We'll post this interview and make sure to include a link to the report at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Hear the Federal Drive on demand. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Still to come, federal agency performance depends on individual accountability. This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. Welcome back to the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Network. Accountability, performance measurement, the interplay between political appointees and career employees, it can all get complicated. And one way to improve agency performance is to make sure people each have specific goals that are expected to meet. That's according to my next guest, longtime federal management professor Bob Tobias. And Bob, you're kind of upset with people that don't really understand that firing large numbers of so-called, quote, unelected bureaucrats is the way to help performance in the government and help deliver services better.
Yes, Tom, I think that's it. You know, we often hear that it's necessary to hold federal employees accountable. When we hear that, the focus is more often than not on non-manager civil service employees. And what we hear is, get those poor performers out of here. What's taking so much time? They're hanging around. Why don't they make it happen? We have to make discharging those folks easier. But I suggest that firing non-manager federal employees will not stimulate more individual performance, and it will not result in more overall better performance in the federal government. What's necessary is holding every level of management in the federal government responsible, holding every level of federal government accountable for creating performance goals and creating performance standards. A recent National Academy of Public Administration paper written by Jeffrey Neal defined accountability as managers at each government level being responsible for defining specific tasks to be performed. They are answerable to someone for accomplishing those tasks, experience consequences for failure to perform the tasks, and receive rewards for exceptional work. Pretty clear, pretty simple, pretty understandable. But the problem is, who at each level is responsible? And if we follow those who say we ought to run the government like a business, every single creative, profitable, private sector business has top to bottom alignment of performance goals and objectives and holds each level responsible for successfully dealing with poor performers. So interesting, I think, is that the top in the federal sector is the U.S. Congress. They're at the top of the food chain. They're analogous to private sector board of directors. But I suggest, Tom, that rather than being a model of holding itself accountable for government performance, it does so much to inhibit effective government performance. They don't enact timely budgets. So if an agency leader creates a strategic plan, creates a budget, we're now 4 months into the fiscal year, and these leaders have no idea whether they're going to get more money, the same money, or less money.
There's no budget in sight, really.
So how do I, as a leader, plan expenditures? The answer is, I can't. Congress doesn't hold serious oversight hearings about what are agency goals and objectives. They don't do that and haven't done it for many, many, many years. And they don't point out agency leaders who are really successful in achieving goals and objectives and giving them more money to spend because they're efficient and effective. And of course, they fail to timely fill political appointee vacancies and then say agencies are directionless.
We are speaking with Bob Tobias. He's former NTEU president and professor in the Key Executive Leadership Program at American University. It's really incumbent on the administration to set goals, push those down through its political appointees, who then should be trained or educated, if they're new to this, how to inculcate that through the bureaucracy that they oversee. And then the standing career federal senior leaders should know how to do that translation and turn that into some sort of a cogent way for people to have understanding what they're expected to do. Is that the better model here?
Well, it is a better model, but I think, Tom, each of those levels is failing to do what it is you suggest ought to be done. So the next level below the Congress is the chief executive officer of the executive branch, the president of the United States.
But that's where the corporate argument doesn't quite hold up, because the president is not strictly accountable to Congress because we have separation of powers.
Well, the president is not directly responsible, but the president selects political appointees who are responsible to Congress. And I suggest that no political appointee, certainly in my many years, has ever been asked to resign for failing to achieve performance goals and objectives, ever. And a president who is really serious about accountability and performance goals at the beginning of an administration would say, I'm going to nominate you for a political appointee position, but be advised that on an annual basis, I'm going to evaluate whether you achieve agency goals and objectives. And if you don't, I'm going to ask you to resign. So yes, the president is not directly responsible, but he or she is responsible for implementing legislative goals and implementing the policy goals of an administration. And then you get to the next level, political appointees. They're responsible for setting performance goals, and yet the 2023 Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey tells us that only 66% of federal employees agree that managers communicate the goals of the organization, 66%. And only 45% of federal workers agree with the statement, in my work unit, differences in performance are recognized in a meaningful way. So if I don't know what the standard is, and I can't differentiate my performance from another, how can I hold anyone accountable for failing to achieve an undefined task?
Well, that takes us back to your original thesis here, is that, you know, just simply firing people arbitrarily is not going to get your performance goals. So it sounds like people have three elements of whether there is meaningful connection between how they perform and whether they have their job. One is raises and promotions. And so people that do perform well should get more money and more responsibility. Those that aren't horrible or damaging, maybe, but are useful to the organization, well, they don't get a promotion, they get the standard raise every year. And if people are not meeting the basic goals, then you have to let them go. And it's actually not as difficult as people often make it out to be in the federal government. And we know that there's, I think it's 15,000 or so people are fired every year from the federal government. But when there is no discretion in how much of a compensation change someone can get, it's kind of hard to tie performance to compensation. Everybody gets the same 4.2% or whatever it was this year, as opposed to, I've got a pool of 4%. I'm going to give these people, I mean, this lady was fantastic. She's going to get 8%. This guy was marginal. He's going to get 0.5%.
Well, the fact is, Tom, that agencies do have discretion to provide annual awards for people who perform exceptionally. And how those awards are made is really part of this issue. Because if the goal is not clear and you get an award and I don't, I'm saying, how come old Tom got that award? I did more than he did. And yet neither one of us have measurable goals. So I conclude that you must, Tom, you must be liked by your supervisor and I'm hated.
Yeah, arbitrary and capricious. That's the worst thing to feel about an organization. So your bottom line advice for the POLITs and the senior executive service?
Well, the senior executive service, you know, I wish they would take more responsibility, but only half of federal employees believe their senior leaders generate high levels of motivation, and only 62% believe their senior leaders maintain high levels of honesty and integrity. So those folks aren't doing their job. So this idea of creating performance goals, performance standards, measuring work is not an easy task. And it's not well done in the private sector either. 95% of private sector managers in a recent Gallup poll said they're unsatisfied with their organization's performance review systems. But what's clear is creating an accountable performance management system cannot be solved by scapegoating non-manager federal employees by making it easier to fire them. They live in an unaccountable system, Tom.
Bob Tobias is former NTEU president and also professor in the Key Executive Leadership Program at American University. Let's hope they're listening. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much, Tom. My pleasure.
We'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Hear the Federal Drive on your schedule. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. The intelligence community has a new strategy for using open source information. The goal is for spy agencies to share more open source data internally and use artificial intelligence to organize and analyze the vast amounts of public and commercial data. For more, Federal News Network's Justin Doubleday spoke with the Open Source Intelligence Executive at the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, Jason Barrett.
This has been a long time coming. It's been years since the IC had a holistic public-facing document. In fact, it hasn't happened in more than a decade to have a public-facing document on open source intelligence and the strategy behind it for the IC. And so we're excited to have the document out, and we're excited for a couple of reasons. One, we're reaching an inflection point within not just the government, but I would say the public intelligence sector. And that is really being driven by advancements in artificial intelligence and just the volume of data in general. And so that is impacting us in the IC quite a bit. You have a deeply passionate group of individuals within the OSINT community who have been doing some phenomenal work over the past couple of years. And they are excited at the organic level to have been a part of putting this together. And we're excited to have it out. I know the DNI is excited to have it out. And obviously, she and Director Burns felt strongly enough to put the foreword in front of the document. So again, a lot of that really served as the basis and the motivation for the document and getting it out and having the chance to now be able to talk about it with anybody we see and meet with is a really useful thing.
A really helpful overview. And so, obviously the strategy is out there at a high level. What are some of the big goals that you all are getting after under this document? What are some of the specific things that it says the IC must do to be successful in the OSINT space?
So overall, if you step back and look at the document, it really has four key themes. It's focused on data and the sharing of it, integrating our overall collection capabilities, driving innovation in this space through new capabilities, obviously, and then developing the next generation of tradecraft and work and our workforce. And what does all of that mean? I think if you look at where we are right now in the IC, particularly in the OSINT community, we've got some really strong players, and they have particular expertise in certain areas that they are really delivering. And so what the strategy does is it accentuates those and really allows us to rely on some of our key players to deliver capabilities and expand and accelerate our data sharing, and then also take some of the best practices from a variety of different components, including some of the, I would say, smaller in number, but not necessarily in stature elements, who have been doing some phenomenal OSINT work over the past couple of years. So certainly this really draws on many of the best practices and then puts them together in a cohesive strategy.
I want to drill down into this idea of coordinating on open source data acquisition and expanding data sharing. Do you envision a day where there's, all 18 agencies are able to pull on one pool of open source data? I mean, how realistic is that? How do you get to that point where at least you have this more centralized location for accessing open source data and more interoperable data across different agencies and contracts?
There's been such a variety of different places within the IC who are looking for more and more of this open source information. The problem is that it has been disaggregated, it's been ad hoc, and it has been decentralized to the point of being difficult to manage. Now, what OSC has done a really phenomenal job of, and I know DIA is working extremely hard to deliver another platform as well. There is the ability now within OSE to start to centralize and connect different data sets, which I think is going to be a phenomenal asset for the IC long term. The important part that we have to really do now is coordinate these efforts in a way that makes sense. We have to streamline the acquisition process. We have to set up contracts that, from a first principle perspective, are designed to share, whether or not it happens right away or whether or not an agency can modify the contract. Either one of those ultimately will accomplish the goal, But it has to start out from the first principle of we are going to share this information, and we're going to share it in a venue that allows us to get to the, as many IC components as possible at the lowest level as possible, so that ultimately we're able to drive more information and decision advantage to the policymakers in a more efficient channel. And I think that's ultimately the end goal here from a commercial data and open source data perspective, is using the tools and the capabilities that that industry has maybe generated and developed, taking those best practices and sometimes those tools, and then putting around them data sets that we believe make the most sense, and scaling that to the IC, so that ultimately we're not just supporting the warfighter immediately with answers to their open source needs, but we're also able to deliver that input and those answers to our policymakers in a much more efficient manner.
This kind of leads into my next question about the OSINT workforce. I know that's one of the big goals under this new strategy is developing a next generation OSINT workforce and tradecraft, as you both have mentioned already. Can you talk a little bit more about what you all are going to do, how you envision that next generation OSINT workforce, how they're going to be trained, you know, the roles that are necessary to carry out this strategy, and what kind of skills are necessary within the IC to carry out these OSINT goals?
Sure. So if you look at where we're at right now, I want to go back to that phrase I used earlier about being at an inflection point. The volume of data and the value of it in general that's coming from the public and commercial space is enormous, and it's growing year over year. We are using it across the board in the IC to drive mission, you know, in every direction. And as a result, there's a growing thirst from it from our all source analysts, as well as our individual operators. What we're focused on is really looking at the holistic picture of how to develop a workforce that not just has that OSINT expertise, but appreciates how to integrate that OSINT expertise into the broader community and vice versa. So you need both training that is relevant to the all source analysts and the collectors that are primarily GEOINT or SIGINT or HUMINT collectors or MASINT collectors, but you also need to develop the tradecraft and the training that is exclusive to just the OSINT community and that will make that community more potent and efficient. I think the true value of doing this work and of kind of revolutionizing our community, or as the DNI phrased it, transforming the IC over multiple years through this work, is that we can do it for less cost and fewer people in general in the OSINT space than others can do it in the other intelligence disciplines. And that is a differentiator that we really need to, I think, not just appreciate, but support in a greater way. And I think there is a groundswell of interest and support from industry and from academia drawing attention to this. Certainly think tanks have done the same, but I think there's also a growing appreciation within the community that that can happen, because ultimately, if we develop and train and equip our analysts and our OSINT collectors to do a more efficient and effective job of collecting, of understanding the provenance of the data that they're collecting and of distributing that information, what we will ultimately be able to do is drive intelligence analysis and production across the board much faster, and at the same time, allow some of our more exquisite collection that is classified to be further supported by a realignment of resources. So we believe that there's huge value add, not just in being able to further support the OSINT community long-term, but also being able to use the work that we're doing to actually complement and further support our exquisite collection on the classified side.
Jason Barrett, the Open Source Intelligence Executive at the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, speaking with Federal News Network's Justin Doubleday. This is The Federal Drive with Tom Temin. For the latest updates, stay with federalnewsnetwork.com or follow us on Facebook and LinkedIn. I'm Tom Temin.